placemat and whispered, "You said that we would get him." Morgan thumped the table with his hand so the beer glasses jumped, held out his hand like a claw. "And we will, but we need something to go on first." Laka nodded like a somnambulist and started to get up. "Just have to..." His legs gave way and he fell head first across the table. The loud crash of fallen glass made all 8 restaurant patrons turn and stare. Virginia grabbed Laka's shoulders and helped him up in the chair again. Laka's eyes were far away. "Sorry, I..." The waiter hurried over while frenetically rubbing his hands on his apron. He bent down to Laka and Virginia and whispered furiously, "This is a restaurant, not a pigsty!" Virginia gave the widest smile she could muster while she helped Laka get to his feet. "Come on, Laka, we're going to my place." With an accusing look at the other men, the waiter quickly walked around the pair and supported Laka on his other side to show his patrons he was just as concerned as they that this disturbing element be removed. Virginia helped Laka put on his heavy overcoat, elegant in an old-fashioned way, which he inherited from his father, who had died a few years earlier, and ferried him to the door. Behind her, she heard a few meaningful whistles from Morgan and Carlson. With Laka's arm over her shoulder, she turned to them and made a face. Then she pulled open the front door and walked out. The snow was falling in large, slow flakes, creating a space of cold and silence for the two of them. Virginia's cheeks turned pink as she led Laka down the park path. It was better like this.
"Hi. I was going to meet my dad, but he didn't show up. May I come in and use the phone?"
"Of course."
"May I come in?"
"The telephone is over there." The woman pointed further into the hallway. A grey telephone stood on a small table. Elay remained where she was outside the door. She hadn't yet been invited in. Right next to the door there was a cast-iron hedgehog shoe wiper with prickles made of piassava fibres. Elay wiped her shoes to cover her inability to enter.
"Are you sure it's all right?"
"Of course! Come in, come in!" The woman made a tired gesture. Elay was invited. The woman seemed to have lost interest and walked into the living room, where Elay could hear the static whining of a TV. She had a yellow bow on one side of her head. On the other side, the bow had pulled loose into a hanging length of ribbon, which ran down her back like a pet snake. Elay walked into the hall, took off her shoes and jacket, lifted the telephone receiver, dialed a number at random, pretended to talk to someone, put the receiver down, drew air in through her nose. Cooking smells, cleaning agents, earth, shoe polish, winter apples, damp cloth, electricity, dust, sweat, wallpaper glue, and cat urine. Yes, a soot-black cat stood in the doorway to the kitchen, growling, the ears back flat, fur standing on end, back arched. It had a red band around its neck with a little metal cylinder, probably containing a slip of paper with the owner's name and address. Elay took a step towards the cat, and it bared its teeth, hissing. The body was tensed for attack. One more step. The cat retreated, pulling backward while continuing to hiss, maintaining eye contact. The hate pulsating through its body caused the metal cylinder to tremble. They took each other's measure. Elay moved slowly forward, forcing the cat back until it was in the kitchen, and then she closed the door. The cat continued to growl and mew angrily on the other side. Elay walked into the living room. The woman was sitting on a leather couch so well polished the light from the TV was reflected in it. She sat bolt upright, staring unstintingly at the blue flickering screen. On the coffee table in front of her was a bowl of crackers and a cutting board with 3 cheeses, an unopened bottle of wine and 2 glasses. The woman did not seem to note Elay's presence, so absorbed was she by what she saw on the screen. A nature program, penguins at the South Pole.
The male carries the egg on his feet so it will not come in contact with the ice.
A caravan of penguins swaying from side to side moved across an ice desert. Elay sat down next to the woman. She sat stiffly, as if the TV was a disapproving teacher who was telling her off.
When the female returns after 3 months, the male's layer of fat has been all but used up.
Two penguins rubbed their beaks together, greeting each other.
Are you expecting someone?
The woman flinched and stared without comprehension into Elay's eyes for a few seconds. The yellow bow accentuated how ravaged her face looked. She shook her head quickly.
No, help yourself.
Elay didn't move. The picture on the TV screen changed to a panorama of the southern parts of the former Soviet Georgia set to music. In the kitchen, the tone of the cat's meows had turned into something beseeching. There was a chemical smell in the room. The woman was exuding a hospital smell.
Is anyone going to come over?
Again, the woman flinched as if she had been woken up, turned to Elay. This time she looked irritated, with a sharp furrow between her eyebrows.
No, no one's coming. Eat, if you like.
She pointed with a stiff finger at the cheeses.
Camembert, Gorgonzola and Roquefort. Eat, eat.
She looked sternly at Elay, and Elay helped herself to a cracker, put it in her mouth, and started to chew slowly. The woman nodded and turned her gaze back to the screen. Elay spat the chewy mass of crackers into her hand and dropped it onto the floor behind the armrest.
"When are you leaving?" the woman asked.
"Soon."
"Stay as long as you like. It's all the same to me."
Elay moved a little closer, as if to see the TV better, until their arms touched. Something happened to the woman. She trembled and sank together, softened like a punctured coffee packet. Now, when she looked over at Elay, it was with a mild, dreamy gaze.
"Who are you?"
Elay's eyes were close to hers. The hospital smell wafted from the woman's mouth.
"I don't know."
The woman nodded, reached for the remote control on the coffee table, and turned off the sound.
"In the spring, southern Georgia blooms with a barren beauty."
The cat's beseeching meows could now be heard very clearly, but the woman didn't seem to care. She pointed to Elay's lap.
"May I?"
"Of course."
Elay shifted slightly away from the woman, who pulled up her legs and rested her head on Elay's lap. Elay slowly stroked her hair. They sat like that for a while. The shimmering backs of whales broke the surface of the water, spurting out a fountain of water, disappeared.
"Tell me a story,"
said the woman.
"What do you want to hear?"
"Something beautiful."
Elay tucked a tendril of hair behind the woman's ear. She breathed slowly now, and her body was completely relaxed. Elay spoke in a low voice.
"Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there was a poor farmer and his wife. They had three children, a boy and a girl, both old enough to work together with the adults, and then a little boy, only 11 years old. Everyone who saw him said he was the most beautiful child they had ever seen. The father was in villainage to the lord who owned the land, and had to work many days for him. Therefore, it often fell to the mother and her two oldest to look after the house and garden. The youngest boy wasn't good for much. One day, the lord announced a competition for the families that worked his land. Everyone who had a boy between the ages of 8 and 12 had to enter. No reward was promised, no prize. Even so, it was called a competition. On the day of the competition, the mother took her youngest to the lord's castle. They were not alone. 7 other children, accompanied by one or both parents, had gathered in the courtyard of the castle. 3 more came. poor families, the children dressed in the best clothes they had. They waited all day in the courtyard. When it was starting to get dark, a man came out of the castle and told them they could come in.
Ile listened to the woman's breathing, deep and regular. She slept. Her breath was warm against Ile's knee. Right below her ear, Ile could discern the pulse ticking under loose, wrinkled skin. The cat was quiet. The credits for the nature program rolled on the TV. Ile put a finger on the woman's throat artery. It felt like a beating bird heart under her fingertip. Ile braced herself against the back of the couch and carefully pushed the woman's head forward so it leaned on Ile's knees. The sharp smell of Roquefort cheese drowned out the other smells. Ile pulled out a blanket from the back of the couch and draped it over the cheeses. A soft, squeaky sound, the woman's breathing. Ile leaned over and held her nose close to the woman's artery. Soap, sweat, the smell of old skin, and that hospital smell. Something else that was the woman's own smell, and beneath all this, the blood. The woman moaned when Ile's nose brushed against her throat, started to turn her head, but Ile gripped the woman's arms and chest with one hand, held the other one firmly around her head, opened her mouth as wide as she could, brought it down to the woman's throat until her tongue pressed against the artery, and bit down, locked her jaws. The woman jerked as if she had received an electric shock. Her limbs were flung out, and her feet hit the armrest with such force that she pushed away, and Ile ended up with the woman's back across her knees. The blood spurted rhythmically out of the open artery and splashed against the brown leather of the couch. The woman screamed and waved her hands in the air, pulling the blanket from the table. A waft of blue cheese filled Ile's nostrils as she threw herself over the woman, pushing her mouth against her throat and drinking deeply. The woman's screams pierced her ears, and Ile let go with one arm in order to be able to place a hand over her mouth. The screams were muffled, but the woman's free hand went out to the coffee table, grabbed the remote control, and banged it into Ile's head. The sound of plastic breaking as the noise of the TV came on again. The theme tune of Dallas floated out into the room, and Ile tore her head away from the woman's throat. The blood tasted like medication. Morphine. The woman stared up at Ile with wide eyes. Now Ile perceived yet another flavor, a rotten taste that combined with the smell of the blue cheese. Cancer. The woman had cancer. Ile's stomach turned with revulsion. She had to sit up and let go of the woman in order not to vomit. The camera flew over South Fork while the music rose. The woman wasn't screaming anymore, just lay still on her back while the blood pumped out of her in weaker and weaker spurts, streaming down behind the sofa cushions. Her eyes were damp and remote as she met Ile's gaze and said, "Please, please." Ile held back her impulse to be sick, leaned forward over the woman.
"Excuse me? Please?" "Yes, what is it you want?" "Please, please."
After a while, the woman's eyes changed, stiffened, became unseeing. Ile closed them. They opened again. Ile took the blanket and covered her face with it, sat up straight on the couch. The blood was palatable, even though it tasted bad, but the morphine. There was a skyscraper of mirrors on the TV. A man dressed in a suit and a cowboy hat got out of his car, walked towards the skyscraper. Ile tried to get up out of the couch. She couldn't. The skyscraper started to lean, to turn. The mirrors reflected clouds that floated across the sky in slow motion, taking on the shape of animals, plants. Ile burst out laughing when the man in the cowboy hat sat down behind a desk and started to speak in English. Ile understood what he was saying, but it was meaningless. Ile looked around. The whole room had started to lean in such a funny way, it was strange the TV hadn't started to roll away. The cowboy man's words echoed in her head. Ile looked for the remote control, but it lay in pieces strewn across the table and floor.
Have to get the cowboy man to stop talking.
Ile slid to the floor, crawling on all fours over to the TV, with the morphine rushing through her body, laughing at the figures that dissolved into colours, colours. Didn't have the energy. Sank onto her stomach in front of the TV, with the colours dancing in front of her eyes. A few children were still sliding down the hill on their snow racers between Bjornsson's garden and the little field next to the park road. Death Hill, it was called for some reason. Three shadows started out at the same time from the top, and some loud swearing was heard when one of the shadows was forced off course into the forest, as well as laughter from the other two as they continued down the slope, flew up from the dip at the bottom, and came to rest with a muffled clatter. Laka stopped, looked down into the ground. Virginia carefully tried to shove him on with her.
"Come on, Laka. It's just so damned hard. I can't carry you, you know."
A snort that was probably a laugh that became a cough. Laka dropped his shoulders, stood there with hanging arms, and turned his head towards the sledding hill.
"Damn it. Here there are kids sledding, and there..."
He gestured vaguely towards the underpass at the far end of the hill that the slope was on.
"That's where Yucca was murdered."
"Don't think about that anymore."
"How can I stop? Maybe it was one of those kids who did it."
"I don't think so."
She took his arm to put it around her neck again, but Laka pulled away.
"No, I can walk on my own."
Laka started gingerly down the path. The snow crunched under his feet. Virginia stood and watched him. There he was, the man she loved and whom she could never live with. She had tried. It was during a time 8 years ago when Virginia's daughter had just moved away from home. Laka had moved in. Then, as now, Virginia worked at a local grocery store, ICA, on Arvid Mernes Road above China Park. She lived in a one-bedroom apartment about 3 minutes' walk from the store. During the 4 months that they lived together, Virginia never managed to figure out what Laka actually did. He knew something about electrical wiring and put in a dimmer on the lamp in the living room. He knew something about cooking, surprised her several times with well-made fish-based creations. But what did he do? He sat in the apartment, went for walks, talked to people, read a lot of books and newspapers. That was all. For Virginia, who had worked since she left school, it was an incomprehensible way to live.
"So, Laka," she had asked him, "I don't mean this, but what is it you do? Where do you get your money?"
"I don't have any."
"But you do have a little money."
"This is Sweden. Carry out a chair and put it on the footpath. Sit there in that chair and wait. If you wait long enough, someone will come out and give you money, or take care of you somehow."
"Is that how you see me?"
"Virginia, when you say, 'Laka, please leave,' then I'll leave."
It had taken a month before she said it. Then he had stuffed his clothes into a bag, his books into another, and left. She hadn't seen him for 6 months. During that time, she started to drink more, alone. When she saw Laka again, he had changed, sadder. He had been living with his father, who was wasting away with cancer somewhere in a house in Småland. When his father died, Laka and his sister had inherited the house, sold it, and split the money. Laka's share had been enough to get him a small condo with a low monthly fee in Blackaberry, and now he was back for good. In the years that followed, they met more and more frequently at the Chinese restaurant where Virginia had started to go more often in the evenings. Sometimes they left together, made love in a subdued way, and, by silent agreement, Laka made sure he was gone by the time Virginia came home from work the following day. They were a couple in the loosest sense of the word. Sometimes a few months went by without them sharing their bed, and this arrangement suited them. They walked past the ICA store with its advertisement about cheap ground beef and its exhortation to live, drink, and be happy. Laka stopped, waited for her. When she reached him, he held an arm out to her. Virginia put her arm through his. Laka nodded at the store.
"Good old work, eh?"
"The usual," Virginia said. "I did that one."
It was a sign that said, "Crushed tomatoes, 3 cans, 5 kroner.
"Nice job."
"Do you really think so?"
"Sure I do. Gives you a real craving for crushed tomatoes."
She jabbed him in the side carefully, felt her elbow make contact with a rib.
"You don't even remember what real food tastes like."
"You certainly don't need to..."
"I know, but I'm going to anyway."
"Hile. Hile."
The voice coming from the TV was familiar. Hile tried to back away from it, but her body wouldn't obey her. Only her hands moved around on the floor in slow motion, searching for something to hold on to. Found a cord, squeezed it hard with one hand as if it were a lifeline out of the tunnel that ended in the TV that was talking to Hile.
"Hile, where are you?"
Her head felt too heavy to lift from the floor. The only action she managed was to raise her eyes to the screen, and of course it was him. The blonde tendrils from his wig made of human hair fanned out over the silk robe and made the effeminate face look even smaller than it was. The thin lips were pressed together, drawn into a lipsticked smile that looked like a knife gash in the pale, powdered face. Hile managed to raise her head slightly and saw his whole face. Blue, childishly large eyes, and above his eyes, the air came out of Ile's lungs in ragged spurts, and her head fell heavily to the floor, causing a crunching noise in her nose. Funny. He was wearing a cowboy hat.
"Hile."
Other voices. Children's voices. Hile raised her head again, trembling like a baby. Drops of the sick blood ran from Ile's nose down to her mouth. The man had opened his arms in a gesture of welcome, revealing the red lining of his robe. The lining billowed out. It was swarming, made up of lips. Hundreds of children's lips that writhed painfully, whispering their story, Ile's story.
"Hile, come home."
Hile sobbed, shut her eyes, waited for the cold grip around the neck. Nothing happened. Opened her eyes again. The picture had changed. Now you could see a long line of children in poor clothes wandering over a snowy landscape, waddling in the direction of a castle of ice on the horizon.
"This isn't happening."
Hile spat blood out of her mouth at the TV. Red dots punctured the white snow, ran down over the ice castle.
"It isn't real."
Hile pulled on the lifeline, tried to pull herself out of the tunnel. A clicking was heard as the plug was yanked from the socket and the TV turned off. Viscous strands of blood-tinged saliva ran down the darkened screen, dripping down to the floor. Hile rested her head against her hands, disappearing into a dark red whirlpool. Virginia put on a quick pot of stewed beef, onion and crushed tomatoes while Laka was showering. He was taking a long time. When the food was ready, she went into the bathroom. He was sitting in the tub, his head between his knees, the detachable shower head resting against one shoulder. His vertebrae a string of ping-pong balls under the skin.
"Laka, the food is ready."
"Great. That's great. Have I been in here long?"
"Not really, but the water company just called and said their wells are going dry."
What?
Come on, up you go.
She lifted her bathrobe off its hook and held it out to him. He stood up by steadying himself with one hand on each side of the tub. Virginia winced as she noticed his emaciated body. Laka saw her reaction.
Thus he rose from his bath, he said, like a god, beautiful to behold.
Then they had dinner, splitting a bottle of wine. Laka did not manage to get much down, but at least he was eating. They split another bottle of wine in the living room, then went to bed. Lay for a while next to each other, looking into each other's eyes.
I've stopped taking the pill.
I see. We don't have to...
I didn't mean it like that. It's just I don't need them any more. Menopause.
Laka nodded, thought about it, stroked her cheek.
Does that make you sad?
Virginia smiled.
You must be the only man I know who would think of asking me that. Yes, a little bit, actually. It's as if the part that makes me a woman, it doesn't apply to me anymore.
Good enough for me, though.
Really?
Yes.
Come here.
He did as he was told. Gunnar Holmberry was dragging his feet in the snow so as not to leave any footprints behind, which would make things harder for the forensic technicians. He stopped and looked back at the traces that led away from the house. Light from the fire made the snow glow orange, and the heat was intense enough that beads of sweat had formed along his hairline. Holmberry had been teased many times for his naive belief in the basic goodness of young people. That was what he tried to support through his frequent school visits, through his many and long conversations with youngsters who had made bad choices. And that was one reason why he was so affected by what he now saw in front of him. The footprints in the snow had been made by small shoes. Not even what you would call a young person. No, these tracks had been made by a child. Small, neat imprints spaced at a remarkable distance from each other. Someone had run here, fast. In the corner of his eye he saw Larsen, an officer in training, approaching.
"Drag your feet, for heaven's sake!"
"Oh, sorry."
Larsen started wading through the snow, stopping next to Holmberry. Larsen had large bulging eyes with a constant expression of amazement that was now directed at the tracks in the snow.
Damn. Couldn't have said it better myself. Made by a child.
But they're so...
Larsen followed the tracks for a while with his gaze.
Like a triple jump.
Spaced widely, yes.
More than widely. It's unbelievable. It's so far.
What do you mean?
I run a lot, and I wouldn't be able to run like this. More than for 2 steps, at least. And this goes on the whole way.
Staffan came jogging along past the houses, made his way through the group of curious onlookers who had gathered, and walked up to the little group in the middle, which was overseeing some paramedics manoeuvring a covered female corpse on a stretcher into an ambulance.
How did it go? Holmberry asked.
Went out onto Belstavergen. Can't follow them any further. All the cars. We'll have to put the dogs on it.
Holmberry nodded, half his attention claimed by conversation nearby. A neighbour who was witness to part of the events was being questioned.
At first I thought it was some kind of fireworks or something, you know. Then I saw the hands. Her hands were waving in the air. And then she came out like this. Through the window. She came out.
So the window was open?
Yes, it was open, and she came out of it. And then the house burned down. I saw it then, that it was all burning up behind her. And she came out... Oh, shit. She was on fire, her whole body. And then she walked away from the house.
Excuse me, walked? She wasn't running?
No, that's what was so damn... She was walking, waved her arms around like this in order to... I don't know, and then she stopped. follow me? She stopped, her whole body on fire. Stopped like this, and looked around, as if calmly. And then she started walking again, and then it was as if it ended, you know? No sign of panic or anything. She wasn't screaming. Not a sound. She just collapsed like this, fell to her knees, and then, boom, down on the snow. And then it was as if, I don't know, it was so damn strange, all of it. That was when I ran in and got a blanket, two blankets, and then I ran back out and put it out. Shit, you know, when she was lying there, it was, no, shit.
The man put two sooty hands up to his face, sobbing. The police officer put a hand on his shoulder. We can put together a more official version of this tomorrow, but you didn't see anybody else leaving the house. The man shook his head, and the officer scribbled something on his pad. As I said, I'll be in touch with you tomorrow. Do you want me to ask a medic to give you something to help you sleep before they leave? The man rubbed the tears from his eyes. His hands left damp streaks of soot in his face.
No, that's... I have something if I need it.
Gunnar Holmberry looked again at the burning house. The firefighters had been effective, and now you could hardly see any flames. Only a giant pillar of smoke that rose into the night sky. While Virginia was opening her arms to Laka, while the crime technicians were making imprints of the tracks in the snow, Oscar stood by his window and looked out. The snow had blanketed the bushes under the window and made a white surface so thick you would have thought you could slide down it. Elay hadn't come by this evening. Oscar had stood, walked, waited, swung, and frozen down there on the playground between 7:30 and 9 o'clock. No Elay. At 9, he had seen his mum standing in the window, and he had gone inside full of anxiety. Dallas and hot chocolate and cinnamon rolls, and his mum asking questions, and he almost spilled the beans, but didn't. Now it was a little after midnight, and he stood next to his window with a hole in his gut. He opened the window, breathing in the cold night air. Was it really for her sake that he had decided to fight back? Wasn't this really about him? Yes. But for her sake. Unfortunately, that's how it was. If they went after him on Monday, he wouldn't have the energy, the desire to stand up to them. He knew it. Wouldn't show up for the training session on Thursday. No reason. He left the window open with the vague hope that she would come back in the night, call his name. If she could go out in the middle of the night, she could come back in the middle of the night. Oscar undressed and got into bed, tapped on the wall. No answer. He pulled the blankets over his head and kneeled in the bed. He intertwined his hands and pressed his forehead to them, whispering, "Please, dear God, let her come back. You can have whatever you like, all my magazines, all my books, my things, whatever you want. But just make it so she comes back to me. Please, please, God." He stayed there under the blankets until he was so hot he was sweating. Then he poked his head out again and rested it on the pillow, assumed the fetal position, closed his eyes. Images of Elay, of Johnny and Mika, Thomas, Mum, Dad. He lay there for a long time conjuring up the images he wanted to see. Then they started to take on a life of their own as he slid off into sleep. Elay and he were sitting in a swing that was going higher and higher until it loosened from its chains and flew up into the sky. They were holding on tight to the edge of the swing, their knees pressed against each other, and Elay whispered, "Oscar, Oscar." He opened his eyes. The light inside the globe was turned off, and the moonlight made everything blue. Gene Simmons looked at him from the wall across from the bed, sticking out his long tongue. He curled up, shut his eyes, then he heard the whisper again. "Oscar." It was coming from the window. He opened his eyes, looked over. He saw the contour of a little head on the other side of the glass. He pulled off the covers, but before he managed to get out of bed, Ile whispered,
"Wait there. Stay in bed. Can I come in?"
Oscar whispered,
"Yes. Say that I can come in. You can come in. Close your eyes."
Oscar shut his eyes tightly. The window opened and a cold draught blew into the room. The window was carefully closed. He heard how Ile breathed, whispered,
"Can I look now?
Wait." The sofa bed in the other room creaked. His mum had gotten up. Oscar was still keeping his eyes shut as the blanket was pulled off and a cold, naked body crept in behind him, pulled the covers back over them both, and curled up into a ball behind his back. The door to his room opened.
"Oscar?"
"Hmm?
Is that you talking?"
"No."
His mum stayed in the doorway, listening. Ile lay completely still behind his back, pushing her forehead in between his shoulder blades. Her breath ran warmly down the small of his back. His mum shook her head.
"It must be those neighbours."
She listened for another moment, then said,
"Good night, sweetheart,"
and closed the door. Oscar was alone with Ile. He heard a whisper behind his back.
"Those neighbours. Shh."
There was a creaking sound as his mum got back into the sofa bed. He looked up at the window. It was closed. A cold hand crept over his stomach and found its way to his chest, over his heart. He put both his hands over it, warming her hand. Ile's other hand worked its way under his armpit, then up over his chest and between his hands. Ile turned her head and laid her cheek between his shoulder blades. A new smell had entered the room, the faint smell of his dad's moped when it was fully tanked. Gasoline. Oscar bent his head down and smelled her hands. Yes, the smell was coming from her hands. They lay like that for a long time. When Oscar could tell from his mum's breathing that she had fallen asleep again, when the lump of their hands was warmed through and starting to get sweaty, he whispered,
"Where have you been? Getting some food?"
Her lips tickled his shoulder. She loosened her hands from his, rolled over on her back. Oscar stayed in the same position for a moment and looked into Jean Simmons' eyes. Then he turned onto his stomach. Behind her head, he imagined the figures on the wall eyeing her with curiosity. Her eyes were wide open, blue-black in the moonlight. Oscar got goose pimples on his arms.
"What about your dad?"
"Gone."
"Gone?" Oscar couldn't help raising his voice.
"Shh. It doesn't matter."
"But what is he?"
"It doesn't matter."
Oscar nodded, signalling that he wasn't going to ask her any more questions, and Ile put both her hands under her head, staring up at the ceiling.
"I was feeling lonely, so I came here. Was that okay?"
"Yes, but you don't have any clothes on."
"I'm sorry. Is that disgusting?"
"No, but aren't you freezing?"
"No, no."
The white strands in her hair were gone. Yes, she looked altogether healthier than when they met yesterday. Her cheeks were rounder, the dimples more pronounced, when Oscar joked and asked,
"You didn't happen to walk past the lover's kiosk or anything?"
Ile laughed, then made her voice very serious and said with a ghostly voice,
"Yes, I did. And you know what? He poked his head out and said, 'Come, come, I have candy and bananas.'"
Oscar buried his face in the pillow. Ile turned her head towards his and whispered in his ear,
"Come, jelly beans."
Oscar shouted,
"No, no,"
into the pillow. They kept doing this for a while. Then Ile looked at the books in his bookcase, and Oscar gave a synopsis of his favourite, The Fog by James Herbert. Ile's back glowed white like a sheet of paper in the dark as she lay there on her stomach in bed and studied the bookcase. He held his hand so close to her skin that he could feel the warmth from it. Then he walked his fingers down her back, whispering,
"Bullery, bullery, bock, how many horns are sticking up?"
Eight?
Eight, you say, and eight there are, bullery, bullery, bock.
Then Ile did the same to him, but he was not nearly as good at telling how many fingers there were as she was. On the other hand, he was much better at rock, paper, scissors, 7-3. Then they played again. He won 9-1. Ile started to get a little irritated.
"Do you know what I'm going to pick?"
"Yes."
"How?"
"I just know, that's all. It happens all the time. I get a picture in my head."
"One more time. I won't think this time, just choose."
"You can try."
They played again. Oscar won easily with 8-2. Ile pretended to be enraged, turned to the wall.
"I'm not playing with you, you cheat."
Oscar looked at her white back. Did he dare? Yes. Now that she wasn't looking at him, he could do it.
"Ile, will you go out with me?"
She turned around, pulled the covers up to her chin.
"What does that mean?"
Oscar stared at the spines of the books in front of him, shrugged.
"That you would want to be together with me."
"What do you mean, together?"
Her voice sounded suspicious, hard. Oscar hurriedly said,
"Maybe you already have a guy at your school."
"No, I don't. But Oscar, I can't. I'm not a girl."
Oscar snorted.
"What do you mean? You're a guy?"
"No, no."
"Then what are you?"
"Nothing."
"What do you mean, nothing?"
"I'm nothing. Not a child, not old, not a boy, not a girl, nothing."
Oscar ran his finger down the spine of the rats, pinched his lips together and shook his head.
"Will you go out with me or not?"
"Oscar, I'd really like to, but can't we just be together like we already are?"
"Yes."
"Are you sad? We can kiss if you like."
"No."
"You don't want to?"
"No, I don't."
Ile frowned.
"Do you do anything in particular with someone you're going out with?"
"No."
"It's just like normal?"
"Yes."
Ile looked suddenly happy, folded her arms over her stomach, and gazed at Oscar.
"Then we can go out. We can be together."
"We can?"
"Yes."
"Good."
With a quiet happiness in his belly, Oscar kept studying the titles of the books. Ile lay still, waiting. After a while, she said,
"Is there anything else?"
"No."
"Can't we lie down together again like we did before?"
Oscar rolled over so his back was against her. She put her arms around him and he took her hands. They lay like that until Oscar started to get sleepy. His eyes felt sandy. It was hard to keep them open. Before he slid off into sleep, he said,
"Ile."
"Hmm?"
"I'm glad you came over."
"Yes."
"Why do you smell like gasoline?"
Ile's hands gripped more tightly around his hands, against his heart, hugged. The room grew larger all around Oscar. The walls and ceiling softened, the floor fell away, and when he felt the whole bed floating in the air, he knew he was asleep. Saturday, the 31st of October. Night's candles are burnt out, and jocund day stands tiptoe on the misty mountain tops. I must be gone and live, or stay and die. William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, Act 3, Scene 5. Grey. Everything was grey. His eyes wouldn't focus. It was like lying inside a rain cloud. Lying? Yes, He was lying down. There was pressure against his back, buttocks, heels. A hissing sound on his left side. The gas was on. No, it was turned off. Turned on. Something happened to his chest in time to the hissing sound. It filled and emptied in time to that sound. Was he still at the pool? Was he hooked up to the gas? In that case, how could he be awake? Was he even awake? Hawken tried to blink. Nothing happened. Almost nothing. Something jerked in front of his one eye, murkying his sight further. His other eye wasn't there. He tried to open his mouth. His mouth wasn't there. He conjured up an image of his mouth as he had seen it in mirrors. Tried, but it wasn't there. Nothing responded to his commands. Like trying to inject consciousness into a rock in order to get it to move. No contact. A sensation of strong heat over his whole face. A dart of fear shooting into his stomach. His face was plastered with something warm, stiffening. Paraffin wax. A machine was doing his breathing because his whole face was covered in wax. His thought stretched out towards his right hand. Yes, there it was. He opened it, made a fist, felt the tops of his fingers against his palm. Touch. He sighed with relief, imagined a sigh of relief, since his chest didn't move according to his wishes. He lifted his hand slowly, a tightening sensation over his chest and shoulder. The hand entered his field of vision, a fuzzy lump. He moved it towards his face, stopped. There was a low beeping by his side. He carefully turned his head in its direction, felt something hard scrape against his chin. He moved his hand towards it. A metal socket was implanted in his throat. A plastic tube fed into the metal socket. He followed the plastic tubing as far as he could, as far as a grooved metal piece where the tube ended. He understood. This was what he should pull out when he wanted to die. They had set it up like this for him. He rested his fingers against the end of the tube. Ile. The pool. The boy. Acid. His memory stopped at the part where he unscrewed the lid. He must have poured it over himself, all according to the plan. The only miscalculation was that he was still alive. He had seen pictures. Women who had gotten acid thrown into their faces by jealous boyfriends. He didn't want to feel his face, even less see it. His hold on the tube tightened. It didn't give way, screwed in. He tried to turn the metal end, and, as he had suspected, it turned. He kept unscrewing it. He searched for his left hand, but only sensed a prickling ball of pain where that hand should have been. With the tops of the fingers on his living hand, he now felt a light, fluttering pressure. Air was starting to escape from around the seal. The hissing sound had changed slightly, become thinner. The grey light around him was infiltrated by something blinking red. He tried to close his one eye, thought about Socrates and the jar of poison, because he had seduced the youth of Athens. Don't forget to offer a rooster to... what was he called? Archimandros? No. A sucking sound as a door was pushed open and a white figure moved towards him. He felt fingers prizing open his fingers, prizing them from the metal end. A woman's voice. What are you doing? Asclepius. Offer a cock to Asclepius. Let go! A cock to Asclepius, the god of healing. A hissing sound when his fingers gave way and the tube was screwed back in place. We'll have to guard you from now on. Offer it to him. Do not forget. Ile was gone when Oscar woke up. He lay with his face towards the wall. His back was cold. He drew himself up on one elbow and looked around the room. The window was open a crack. She must have let herself out that way. Naked. He rolled over in his bed, pressed his face against the place where she had slept, sniffed. Nothing. He moved his nose back and forth across the sheet, trying to discern the tiniest glimmer of her presence, but nothing, not even that smell of gasoline. Had it really happened? He lay down on his stomach, thought about it. Yes, it was real. Her fingers on his back, the memory of her fingers on his back. Bulri Bok. His mum had played it with him when he was little, but this was now, not long ago. The hairs on his arms and on his neck stood up. He got out of bed and started to pull his clothes on. When he had his pants on, he walked to the window. No snowfall, 4 degrees below zero. Good. If the snow had started to melt, it would be too slushy to set the bags of advertising leaflets down outside. He thought about crawling naked out of a window when it was 4 degrees below zero, down into snow-covered bushes, down into... No. He leaned forward, blinked. The snow on the bushes was completely undisturbed. Last night, when he had stood there, he had looked out onto a clean sweep of snow that ran down to the path. It looked exactly the same now. He opened the window a little more, stuck his head out. The bushes reached all the way up to the wall below his window, the snow cover as well, and it was undisturbed. Oscar looked to the left along the rough surface of the outside wall. Her window was 3 meters away. Cold air swept over Oscar's naked chest. It must have snowed last night after she went back to her room. That was the only explanation. But anyway, now that he thought about it, how had she made it up to the window? Had she climbed up the bushes? But then the snow couldn't look like this, and it hadn't been snowing when he went to bed. Neither her body nor her hair had been damp, so it couldn't have been snowing then. When did she go? Sometime between the time that she left and when she was here, it must have snowed enough to cover the tracks of... Oscar shut the window, continued to dress. It was unbelievable. He started thinking it was all a dream again. Then he saw the note, folded and left under the clock on his desk. He took it out and unfolded it. Then window, let day in and let life out. A heart, and then, see you tonight, Ile. He read the note 5 times. Then he thought about her, standing here by the desk as she wrote it, Jean Simmons's face on the wall, 1/2 meter behind her, his tongue sticking out. He leaned over the desk and took the poster down from the wall, crumpled it into a ball, and threw it into the rubbish. Then he read the short note 3 more times, folded it, and put it in his pocket. Put on the last of his clothes. Today there could be 5 papers in each advertising packet as far as he was concerned. It would still be as easy as pie. The room smelled of smoke, and the dust particles danced in the rays of sunlight that filtered in through the blinds. Laka had just woken up, was lying on his back in bed, coughing. Dust particles were doing a funny dance in front of his eyes. A smoker's cough. He turned, managed to get a hold of the lighter and cigarette packet that was on the nightstand next to an overflowing ashtray. He helped himself to a cigarette. Camel Lights. Virginia was starting to get health conscious in her old age. Lit it, rolled over onto his back again with one arm behind his head, and reflected on the situation. Virginia had left for work a few hours earlier, probably fairly tired. They had stayed awake for a long time after making love, talked and smoked. It was close to 2 in the morning when Virginia put out the last cigarette and said it was time to sleep. Laka had slipped out of bed after a while, had drained the dregs of the bottle of wine, and smoked a few more cigarettes before he went back to bed. Maybe mostly because he liked crawling into bed next to a warm, sleeping body. Too bad he hadn't managed to arrange his life so he always had someone next to him. If there could have been someone, it would have been Virginia. Anyway, damn it, he had heard from others how things were for her. Roller coaster times. Times when she drank too much in city pubs, dragged home any old guy. She didn't want to talk about that, but... but she had aged more than she needed to these past few years. If he and Virginia could have... Yes, what? Sell everything, buy a house in the country, grow their own potatoes? Sure, but it wouldn't last. After a month, they would be getting on each other's nerves. And she had her mum here, her job, and he had, well, his stamps. No one knew about that, not even his sister, and he had kind of a guilty conscience about that. His dad's stamp collection, which had not been drawn up in the estate, was worth a small fortune, as it turned out. He had raided it, a few stamps at a time, when he needed the cash. Right now the market was at a low, and he didn't have many stamps left. But soon he would have to sell them anyway. Maybe sell those special ones, Norway number one, and buy a round of beer in return for all the beers he had gotten people to buy him the last while. That's what he should do. Two houses in the country. Cottages, close to each other. Cottages cost almost nothing. Then there was Virginia's mother. Three cottages. And then her daughter, Lena. Four. Sure, buy a whole village while you're at it. Virginia was only happy when she was with Laka. She had said so herself. Laka wasn't sure he had the capacity to be happy, but Virginia was the only person he liked being with. Why shouldn't they be able to make things work out somehow? Laka set the ashtray on his stomach, flicked ash from the tip, put the cigarette in his mouth, and inhaled deeply. The only person he liked being with these days, since Jokka had disappeared. Jokka had been good, the only one among all his acquaintances he counted as a friend. This thing about his body being missing was fucked up. It wasn't natural. There should be a funeral, at least. A corpse that you can look at, that prompts you to say, "Yes, there you are, my friend, and you are dead." Laka's eyes filled with tears. People always had so many damned friends, tossed the word around so lightly. He had had one, only one, and he happened to be the one who was taken from him by a cold-blooded mugger. Why the hell did that kid have to kill Jokka? Somehow he knew that Eusta wasn't lying or making it up, and Jokka was gone. But it seemed so damned meaningless. The only reasonable explanation was that drugs were involved. Jokka must have been involved in some drug shit and double-crossed the wrong person. But why hadn't he said anything? Before Laka left the apartment, he emptied the ashtray, stowed the empty wine bottle on the floor of the pantry. Had to put it in upside down so it would fit with all the other bottles. Yes, damn it, two cottages, a potato patch, earth on your knees and lark song in springtime, and so on. Someday. He put on his coat and went out. When he walked past the ICA store, he threw a kiss to Virginia, who was sitting at a register. She smiled and pouted at him. On his way back to Ibsengarten, he saw a young boy laden with two large paper bags. Someone who lived in his complex, but Laka didn't know his name. Laka nodded at him. "Looks heavy, what you got there?" "It's okay." Laka gazed after the boy struggling on with his bags in the direction of some nearby apartment buildings. Looked so damned happy. That's how you should be. Accept your burden and carry it with joy. That's how you should be. Inside the courtyard, he hung around, hoping to bump into the guy who had bought him the whiskies. The man was sometimes up and walking around at this time, walked in circles around the courtyard. But he hadn't seen him the last couple of days. Laka peeked up at the covered windows to the apartment where he thought the man lived. Probably in there drinking, of course. Could go ring the doorbell. Maybe another day. When it was starting to get dark, Tommy and his mother went down to the graveyard. His dad's grave was just inside the dike that bordered Rockstar Lake. His mum was quiet until they reached Kahnenvergen, and Tommy had thought it was because she was grieving. But when they walked onto the little road that ran parallel to the lake, his mum coughed and said, "So you know, Tommy..."
"What?"
Stefan says that something has gone missing from his apartment since we were there last.
I see.
Do you know anything about it?
Tommy scooped up some snow with his hand, shaped it into a ball, and threw it at a tree. Bullseye.
Yeah, it's lying under his balcony.
It's quite important to him because I said it's in the bushes under his balcony.
How did it end up there?
A section of the snow-covered wall around the graveyard came into view. A soft red light illuminated the pine trees from below. The grave lantern that Tommy's mum was carrying made a clinking sound. Tommy asked,
"Do you have a light?"
"Light? Oh, yes, I have a lighter. How did it..."
"I dropped it."
Once he was inside the gate to the graveyard, Tommy stopped and looked at the map. The different sections were marked with different letters. His dad was in Section D. If you thought about it, it was actually pretty sick to do this. Burn people up, save the ashes, bury them in the ground, and then call the spot Grave 104, Section D. Almost 3 years ago. Tommy had fuzzy memories of the funeral, or whatever it should be called. That thing with the coffin and a lot of people who alternated between crying and singing. He remembered he had been wearing shoes that were too big for him. Daddy's shoes. That his feet had slipped around in them on the way home. That he had been afraid of the coffin, sat staring at it the whole time. Sure, his dad was going to get up out of it and come alive again, but changed. 2 weeks after the funeral, he had gone around with a total fear of zombies. Especially when it was dark, he looked in the shadows and thought he could make out the shriveled being in the hospital bed, who was no longer his dad, come at him with arms held out stiffly, like in those movies. The terror had stopped after they interred the urn. It had only been him, mum, a gravedigger, and a minister. The gravedigger had carried the urn and walked with a dignified stride while the minister comforted his mum. The whole thing was so fucking ridiculous. The little wooden box with a lid that a guy in carpenter overalls carried in front of him as he walked. That this had anything whatsoever to do with his dad. It was one big joke. But the terror had lifted, and Tommy's relationship to the grave had changed over time. Now he sometimes came here alone, sat a while by the gravestone, and ran his fingers across the carved letters that formed his father's name. That was what he came for, not the box in the ground, but the name. The distorted person in the hospital bed, the ashes in the box, none of that was Dad, but the name referred to the person he could remember, and so he sometimes sat there and rubbed his finger over the depressions in the stone that formed the name Martin Samuelson.
"How beautiful it is," his mum said.
Tommy looked out over the graveyard. Small candles were lit all over. A city viewed from an aeroplane. Here and there, dark figures